It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction released the annual report cards this week for schools across the state.
About 84% of Wisconsin's public schools met or exceeded state expectations for the last school year, up slightly from the year before.
This year, though, DPI changed the thresholds for how students scored on state standardized tests, making comparisons a little more difficult than usual.
We're checking in on what we can learn from this year's state report card and how parents and community members can make sense of their local scores.
Sarah Shaw is the Deputy Research Director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, where she focuses on education. Sarah, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, people are familiar with the report cards they take home from school at the end of a school year. These are a little different. What goes into these Department of Public Instruction report cards for schools and districts?
So these district report cards and school report cards are meant to inform parents, community members, schools themselves, and policymakers about how schools are doing and how districts are doing. And they take into account standardized test scores, including both how kids achieve, but also how they've grown compared to other kids like them. And they also bring in factors like attendance or chronic absenteeism and graduation data as well.
A few different criteria, a lot of schools in Wisconsin, a flood of data here. Sarah, what stands out to you big picture in this year's report cards?
Well, this year's report cards, as you mentioned, tell us some things and perhaps are more telling for what they don't tell. So we can see, you mentioned that 84% of public schools met or exceeded expectations. 85% of the private schools that receive report cards, which is not all private schools, also met or exceeded expectations. Of those districts, we had just the public school districts, close to 60% of them meeting expectations, which is kind of the middle ground. So that tells us what they received this year. But the trouble is we want to use the report cards to see how things have changed. Is it a district going in the right direction? Is it struggling more? And because of changes in the scoring, we can't compare these report cards to previous years in a way that allows us to really see what direction a district or a school is going.
Yeah, talk a little more about those test score threshold changes. And those thresholds, I understand, change because the tests changed in what they're measuring in some ways. What went into that decision, a big decision to change the tests and the way we evaluate them?
Yeah, so DPI had updated academic standards and then aligned, in this case specifically, the state tests for third to eighth graders to reflect those updated standards, and then changed the scores and the performance levels, whether we consider a student to be meeting expectations or exceeding or below, based on those new cut scores. The ACT, which is the test for the high schoolers, didn't change, but those cut scores or performance levels did. So that's what's disrupting the comparability with other years. DPI will say that this test is now better aligned to what we actually expect students to be able to do and the skills that they should show, while others are concerned that this constitutes a lowering of standards or that they could have made this change but also still provided a crosswalk to previous years so that we could understand how this year's scores compare with previous years.
On a policy level, what are these tests for? What are education officials, legislators, others taking this test and doing with it, if anything?
So theoretically, these tests can be a great way of giving a snapshot of student learning in a way that can tell parents where their student is at in a standardized way, in a way that allows them to compare to other students and other schools. Can also be a helpful tool for teachers and school leaders and district leaders trying to gauge how well they are doing and where they could modify instruction to reach students better. And it helps policymakers get a sense of how is the state doing? How is a locality doing? Are we setting the conditions such that students can succeed? That's in theory. And when it comes to practice, sometimes we have the questions about, are these tests coming out and do the report cards come out in a timely enough manner to be able to properly inform change? Do parents know how to use these report cards in a way that really helps them advocate for their child or ask good questions? And when we get a change like this in what is getting measured and how, that can disrupt those conversations.
And you just hit on something I really wanted to highlight. For a parent listening, they're nodding along, okay, statewide numbers, whatever. I think they're mostly going to be interested in my kid's school, What did it do? Oh, and up 2 points here and down 2 points there. What would you recommend for a parent looking at their local school and their local district score and how to read these tests and make sense of what they're seeing?
Yeah, so I would probably start by throwing out the idea that we can compare this year's to last year's. You know, going up by 2 points doesn't, we don't know what that means right now, because we know that the DPI changes did lead to higher proficiency levels across the board. So a parent looking at their school and saying, oh, we're more proficient now, isn't equipped to know, and none of us are equipped to know, whether that's because things actually got better or because we just changed how we were measuring things. So I really recommend starting that conversation with bringing it back to my student. And can you tell me what are they doing that's right on grade level, exactly what you expect? Where do you see them shining? Where do you see them struggling? And having that conversation from a growth mindset around every child is bringing a lot of assets into the classroom. And we should hope that every child still has room to grow. And a teacher who's paying attention and a school that's paying attention to learning will be able to answer those questions and support your student to their greatest success. And if they're not equipped, your asking the question is going to help prompt them to think of that.
Talking to Sarah Shaw from the Wisconsin Policy Forum, making sense of the new round of report cards for not students, but for schools and districts around the state. The DPI, the Department of Public Instruction, just put out the latest report cards this week. Sarah, here at Wisconsin today, we were poking around at some school districts around the state. We didn't do a comprehensive data crunch, but it stood out to us at least some districts. Middle schools, more middle schools seem to be not hitting those benchmarks, not hitting the, you know, the satisfactory level. Is that a trend you see around the state, or did we just happen to stumble across districts that had middle schools that were having trouble?
It's a good question and not one that we've looked into specifically, but one piece I'll throw out there is that we have been tracking chronic absenteeism pretty closely. So this is a measure that's included in the state report card. It goes into these scores and it skyrocketed after the pandemic. And middle schoolers, in addition to our elementary schoolers, have been some of the ones that have seen their recovery be slowest. So our high school students typically are absent from school on a chronic basis, meaning they're missing more than 10% of school days in the school year, or usually 18 or more days. So our high schoolers typically have the highest chronic absenteeism rates, but the elementary schoolers and middle schoolers, while they didn't go up as high as high school, also haven't come back down by as much. So I'm curious as to whether we're going to see that as a big factor in how well schools can serve children if children are not there in school.
And you brought up the pandemic, and that's been a big open question. How much did the pandemic impact student performance, school performance after a long stretch of remote learning? Looking over the last few years, Sarah, what do you have your eye on, both in these report cards and in other education data you've been watching to see how kids are doing post the worst days of the pandemic?
Yeah, so that chronic absenteeism data is a big one just because it was so disruptive. We have districts where over 50% of students are not in school, or over 40% of school students are not in school on a regular basis. So that's a big one for us. Mental health outcomes, which we don't have on a district by district level, but we do have state data showing that even before the pandemic, youth mental health was worsening. And so seeing how both at the school level and societally, we can be supporting that. And then academically, and part of our concern here is that whether these report cards and the tests behind them are going to give us a consistent source of data to be able to see what was happening pre-pandemic and what is happening now, to understand whether we really are recovering or whether we've just changed the test and now we can't tell.
Well, it seems like we don't need the report card to tell us absenteeism is a problem. What are you seeing schools do and districts do to try to get kids back into the school building? In the old days, they had the truant officers wandering around town. I don't know if that's a thing anymore. But what kind of outreach is there to try to get kids at the desks?
Right now, it's been a typically more supportive approach than punitive from school districts, really working to reach out to families and find out why our students are missing school. And we hear a whole host of reasons, things like housing instability or rising childcare costs, where an older student might be looking after a younger sibling. Things like mental health come into play if that's going to cause a student to want to avoid school. and potentially have a parent who feels really sympathetic to that concern. There's also cases where transportation has been spotty. We've had a bus driver shortage the last couple of years, which has impacted that. And then I think there's also messaging from the pandemic that we're still shaking off. So the message of you don't go to school if you're sick. Well, that's certainly true if you have COVID-19, but there's a whole range of other illnesses where it's more of a gray area. COVID also taught us that we may not need to be in school. And we have learned that being in school, not for all students, but for many students, really is the best way to have access to learning. So undoing some of that messaging from the pandemic has been a challenge and something that schools can use a really comprehensive, coherent communication strategy, something intentional to tell parents, hey, things have changed. Tell community members, this is now, we're going back to where we believe that school is an important place for your child to be. And if you're not here, you are missed and you're at risk of falling behind.
And you mentioned this report card, of course, doesn't answer everything. In our last half a minute or so, what is the biggest open question for you about how we evaluate student performance in our schools?
I think if we consider specifically the pandemic, Wisconsin pre-pandemic had some of the widest achievement gaps in the country. And so as we recover from the pandemic, I think it's really important for us to be focusing not just on how the state as a whole or on average is recovering, but specifically for our students who are most vulnerable pre-pandemic. Are we letting them fall further behind, or are we putting really intentional supports in there and looking at them carefully to make sure we're supporting them in the best way possible?
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Sarah Shaw, Deputy Research Director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. She was with us today to review the annual Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction school report cards that were released this week. Want to hear from you. Let's pick one particular point. Absenteeism. Has your kid had trouble making it to school? What is the problem? What kind of things, what kind of obstacles are there? What could help you solve that? If you're a teacher, what are you seeing in your classrooms? Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up amid a nationwide shortage of medical examiners who investigate causes of death, the head of Wisconsin's Professional Association shares why this work is a calling.
When I die, I want somebody to respect me, and I want somebody to cover me up, and I want somebody to take care of me for my family.
That conversation is just ahead on Wisconsin Today. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The city of Milwaukee is investing in rehabbing vacant houses for new homeowners. Advocates say the grant-funded programs help city finances and strengthen neighborhoods.
As Nick Rommel reports, the effort makes a difference in people's lives as well.
On the west side of Milwaukee, Pandora, Washington just bought a house.
It feels great. It's still, like, unbelievable. And I get up and be like, ooh.
She'd raised her kids in a property owned by Milwaukee's Public Housing Authority. When they grew up, the agency said she was supposed to move into an older public housing project.
And I was like, absolutely not. That's going backwards. I don't go from a brand new house back to, you know.
Washington looked at the private market, but landlords didn't want to rent to her because she runs a daycare out of her house. When she started seeing ads for a rent-to-own program run by a local nonprofit, she took the chance. Rented for a few years, and now she owns it.
So I'm signing all the papers, and I feel myself finna get choked up as I was signing the papers, and I kept telling myself, you better not cry.
Before she moved in, Washington's house was vacant, a teardown owned by the city. Milwaukee has hundreds of these houses, most of them left by white people who moved to the suburbs in the 50s and 60s, then run into the ground by landlords who didn't pay their property taxes. Last year, the Department of City Development started a program called Homes MKE. It helps local developers rehab some of these abandoned houses and then sell them to new homeowners. That department is led by Lafayette Crump. He says homeownership can have ripple effects from neighborhood stability.
You know, they want to be a part of the fabric of their community.
To municipal finances.
We need these properties to get back into productive use so that they can contribute to paying for all of the services that are so important to city residents.
The city hopes to rehab around 120 houses through the Homes MKE program. The subsidies of between $60,000 and $100,000 per house all come from Milwaukee's slice of federal pandemic aid signed in 2021. Vacant houses in the city are concentrated in majority Black neighborhoods. Restoring them for homeowners could help close a racial inequality. 54% of white people in Milwaukee own their houses. Only 27% of Black people do.
So in our country, we have never built entry-level homes for Black and Latino families.
That's Teague Whaley-Smith. He directs a nonprofit that coordinates housing policy in Milwaukee among residents, city government, and developers.
And the ones that we did build for white families, they didn't sell them to Black and Latino families when they moved on to bigger homes. They sold them to investors or kept them as rental.
It's called the Community Development Alliance, and it's helped start a number of housing initiatives in the city. In recent years, census data is showing an uptick in Black homeownership in Milwaukee again. On the ground, that progress takes a lot of manual labor. Six or seven men are working on this Homes MKE rehab at 27th and Vine, and their boss is Carl Quindell. He runs Strong Blocks, the same nonprofit that renovated Pandora Washington's house. Like a lot of old houses in Milwaukee's inner city, this one has good bones.
You can't build this type of home right now. It would cost $400,000 or $500,000, maybe more, actually.
Quindell says the subsidy he's getting for this house is only a little bigger than what it would cost the city anyway to demolish it.
We're trying to, I think, as a city and program ourselves, say this is actually valuable. You know, our neighborhood's valuable, our neighbors are valuable, and this home is valuable.
Funding won't last forever. Philanthropy or the private sector may have to step in if Milwaukee wants to keep helping lifelong renters become first-time owners. It's a change that means a lot to Pandora Washington.
When you own something, it just feels great because you don't want to work all your life and don't have nothing to show.
So far, 32 houses have been renovated under Homes MKE. 35 more are under construction. Nick Rommel, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Medical examiner and coroner offices play a critical role in communities as they help to identify causes of death.
But according to a recent report by the National Institute of Justice, more than 2,000 of these offices around the country struggle with chronic funding issues, staff shortages, and outdated equipment.
To look at how this issue is affecting our state, we turn to the president of the Wisconsin Coroners and Medical Examiners Association.
Crystal Schaub is chief medical examiner for Oneida, Vilas, and Forest counties in the northernmost parts of Wisconsin. Crystal, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
There's this chronic shortage of staff and funding in medical examiner and coroner offices around the country. Are you having to rely on coroner offices around you if you need help, or what are the protocols?
Well, we don't have people lined up at the doors wanting to do this particular job. And I don't know if it's the fear behind dead bodies or, you know, I don't know what that stigma is there. You have to be a special kind of person to work in this field. You're called out late at nights. You could be stuck on a scene for hours, middle of the woods. It's cold. It's wet. It's just really kind of miserable conditions out there. So I do understand that. We do feel the pressure somewhat up here. Out of the 72 counties that we have in Wisconsin, they're all feeling the pressure of lack of staff for the same reason. We do have mutual aid agreements with all of our surrounding counties and as far down as even Marathon County. And we've had a couple of times, not many, but just a couple, that surrounding agencies have asked us for help because they're short-staffed as well. We thankfully have never had to ask for that mutual aid agreement because we've had staff that was readily available to go help with those calls. But people really just don't want to do this job.
What is the toll on you in this job, and what was your pathway into it?
I have 18 years of prior law enforcement experience, and I was just ready to just find a different path in life. And I did a lot of death investigations when I was part of the patrol units, and I had a conversation with the past medical examiner. I had asked him how I could do his job. You know, would you hire me? I'm really interested in this field. And, you know, I like the puzzle work. And so he hired me part-time. And then officially January of 2019, I took over as the chief medical examiner. So I don't have any medical background. Everything that I learned was on the job training. I send my staff to annual trainings, conferences, anything that I can find that's within my budget to send them to, because I feel like you're not going to get better if you don't learn, and you need to keep those skills up. And training is such an important part of our positions.
You mentioned Marathon County, which is set to revamp their medical examiner's office. They have a new building opening in 2025. It will be much more state-of-the-art, and they're recruiting a physician to be their forensic pathologist. What impact do you think that will have? Will you be able to send autopsies there in Marathon County?
Yes, absolutely. We typically do our autopsies right down at UW-Madison, the forensic pathology department. Sometimes, just depending upon how busy they are, we may use Fond du Lac. I've already talked to the chief medical examiner down there in Marathon County. And so she's been working on this program for such a long time, many years, and little bits of funding here and there. And so she's all set to move forward. And I think they have a tentative open date of July of 2025. And we're really excited for her because she could literally service the entire northern part of Wisconsin, which is quite a few counties. And then, of course, her surrounding counties. And with the lack of facilities to do the autopsies, this is a game changer for us. It would take us an hour to get there versus 3+ hours to have to drive to Madison or Fond du Lac. If we sent somebody to Madison or Fond du Lac to do the autopsy, they're out an entire day. And we don't have the staff to be able to do that anymore. So we could drive a patient down, get the autopsy done. We could even drive them down, drop them off, and come back and get them. It's going to be a huge game changer for us.
Crystal Schaub is with us, Chief Medical Examiner for Oneida, Forest, and Vilas counties in the northernmost parts of the state as we talk about Wisconsin death investigation practices. Crystal, the publication Forensics said New Mexico is pioneering the use of CT scans to reduce autopsy numbers and to help lower costs. Is Wisconsin doing things like this to streamline death investigations and lower costs through technology?
Yes. In fact, Patty Schachner, she was a state representative for quite a few years, and she saw the need. And she was able to apply for grants to get a CT scanner for her office. And so now we have this newer technology coming out. It's called Randox. So the coroner's medical examiners can apply for funding, and they can get these machines that you obtain a sample, a toxicology sample from the patient, and you can run it through this machine, and you get an idea of what drugs they have in their system within 20 minutes. Versus us taking a sample, sending it out to the lab, and now we're waiting on weeks to get that result back. And to have those kind of technologies available to us, you can't even put a dollar amount on that, but it comes down to funding, which a lot of us counties, we just don't have.
And that is happening in St. Croix County, where Patty Schachner is a chief medical examiner. ProPublica recently published the story saying that a sudden death of a baby in Idaho went uninvestigated, and national guidelines suggest taking investigated steps in cases like this. But Idaho state law didn't require any. What would Wisconsin have done differently in a situation like this?
So we don't critique how other people do their jobs. There are different rules. There's different laws amongst all of our states and different guidelines, of course. But I can tell you what we would have done differently based on our laws. And an infant would have went for autopsy. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. That would have happened here. We would have done a full scene investigation according to our guidelines. We would have done the doll reenactment with the family, which we, that is a common practice for us.
What does that mean?
So a doll reenactment is when you, it basically looks like a doll. It doesn't have a face. It doesn't have genitalia, no identifying. It looks like a stuffed beanbag is what it, we're trying to make the families not have to relive every aspect. And if they look at a doll that's got a face, it just really hurts them. Mm-hmm. So this doll is a beanbag in the shape of a body. And we give it to the last person that was with that child. They will take the doll and show us where they were laying in bed. How was the doll laying? You know, what did they do throughout the day or the hours up to the death? And more times than any, that event that led up to that death never leaves the mind of the person that was last with them. It could be a couple hours, it could be a couple of days, it could be a couple of weeks, but we can get so many more details doing the doll reenactment because the person will be able to say, I was laying here, this is how my baby was laying. And then I got up and I put the baby over here and I covered, and they literally will relive every single action that they did. Mm-hmm. And it is so helpful from an investigative standpoint to be able to actually see them doing these actions.
Wow, that's really interesting. Are there other strategies or tactics to help you in this work to better understand how a death occurred? Because you call this work a puzzle work.
It is. Every death is a puzzle. It's up to us to figure out how and why they died. And our strategy going into every single scene is we have to treat it like it's a homicide, and then we downgrade. And that is so we don't miss anything. And we always work with law enforcement. Law enforcement is always present at the scene. We'll talk, we share notes, taking pictures. Sometimes we'll take pictures of all the rooms in the house, not just where the patient is located. We do external exam on the patient, look for any kind of signs of injury, trauma, and try to determine what happened to this person.
Hmm. You call this person a patient, although they are deceased?
Correct. This is my opinion, and I don't know how other medical examiners address their patients. Mm-hmm. Yes, they are deceased. Yes, they are a decedent. Legally, that's what their name is because they are no longer with us. If I call them deceased or a decedent to the family, they're already in so much pain, so much pain. We like to call the person by their name to the family. A patient is more sterile versus dead body, deceased, mm-hmm. deceased. That it's just so final to them, mm-hmm. and it hurts them. We have seen the reaction come from families. And I said, you know, we need to kind of relook at this.
It seems like in so many aspects of your work, you're trying to limit the trauma, contain the trauma, and be really attentive to what these families are facing in that moment.
We try. You know, every person is different. Every family is different. There's never a duplicate encounter. Everybody deals with trauma their own way. And there's a lot of people out there, you know, and I'm talking people in their 40s, 50s, 60s who have never seen a dead body, never. And this could be the most traumatic thing that has ever happened to them. And myself, I've dealt with death my whole life. I've lost lots of family members. I remember seeing dead bodies when I was a little child. Mm-hmm. You know, I lost a sibling in my home when I was 5, and I remember that. And I know that everything I say to them and everything I do to them, they're going to associate that and they're going to remember that. And we want them to go to the next phase of grief as easily as possible. And we sit with them and we talk and we listen to the stories, and the stories are just amazing and heartfelt. And I can't even really put words to the stories that the families tell us about their loved ones. That's important to them. If it's important to them, it's important to me.
I wonder, as we close, how would you like to make your mark on the Wisconsin Coroners and Medical Examiners Association in your term as president?
The simplest answer that I can come up with is unity. You know, we have such a great working relationship with all of our counties right now, and that's been going on for probably decades. And I would like to see that continue. And by keeping that unity together, you expand it. And I'm just going to tell you a story. When I first started doing this job, the chief medical examiner asked me, he said, "Why do you want to do this job?" My heart told me at that moment, the reason I wanted to do this was to shield people. And that's what we did in law enforcement. We shielded people. We keep the monsters at bay. And the citizens in the community, they don't see the monsters like we see the monsters. And when I die, I want somebody to respect me, and I want somebody to cover me up, and I want somebody to take care of me for my family. And that was what I incorporated when I first took over this office, is we need to shield these families from all the nastiness. And they already are traumatized because they lost their loved one. Let's show the patient the dignity that they deserve. And if you do it a couple of times, it becomes a habit. And now, not only are we doing it, we're seeing law enforcement doing it. Law enforcement sees how we do our job, and they will do exactly what we do. And that's the point I'm trying to make. People see what we do, and it's a habit. It becomes a habit for everybody. Mm-hmm. That's what I want.
Crystal, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Crystal Schaub is Chief Medical Examiner for Oneida, Vilas, and Forest Counties, serves as President of the Wisconsin Coroners and Medical Examiners Association. We've been talking about a national shortage of staff in these offices around the country and the impact on death investigations here in Wisconsin.
Still ahead, a new memorial to the Waukesha Christmas Parade tragedy features a tile wall made by the community.
One of the young high school people from South High School band that got hit met for the first time one of the nurses and her family that helped him at one of our tile sessions.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. 3 years ago today, the Waukesha community witnessed a horrific tragedy at its Christmas parade. A driver barreled on the parade route, killing six people and injuring dozens more.
Now, a symbol of Waukesha's healing and resilience is being dedicated today. To honor the victims, a heart-shaped memorial with a wall of community-designed clay tiles will open at Grady Park near downtown Waukesha.
To learn more about the parade memorial, we have Carmen De La Paz, a Waukesha-based carpenter, designer, welder, and Emmy-nominated TV host. Carmen, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And Sean Riley is the city mayor of Waukesha. Mayor Riley, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Mayor Riley, on this third anniversary, how is your community doing?
Well, as I think everyone knows, the community went through a terrible tragedy. It impacted pretty much the entire community. I think the thing that we can take heart from is that the community gathered to help all the people who were traumatically injured, people who lost a family member, all the people who witnessed the tragedy. So how are we doing? I think 3 years out, grief comes to people in different ways, and our community was affected differently depending upon whether you were there, whether you were injured, whether you lost a loved one. But what I take heart from is the fact that our community has helped and come together to help those that were the most impacted. The community support for everyone is truly outstanding.
I wonder, Carmen, how do you see this memorial serving as both a remembrance of the horrible event, but also resilience and hope?
I've had firsthand experience over the last course of almost 2 years since we started the Tile Community Project to actually come face to face with so many people that were affected in all the different ways that Mayor Riley has addressed. And I think in the end that there is a process to grieving and there is a process to healing. And sometimes you take two steps forwards and one step back. And I think that just the memorial as kind of a beacon of something that has brought people together in a healing way is a wonderful step for the community as a whole. We've had little kids involved. I've helped up to elderly people in their 90s make a tile. So it really has encompassed all ages, shapes, and color of our community for this memorial park project, which I think is just wonderful that it's not just from a construction standpoint and not just a beautiful architectural job, but that there is actually the pulse of people embedded into the park.
We're going to talk about the tiles in a moment, but Mayor Riley, can you walk us through the memorial and give us a picture in our mind's eye what it looks like?
Sure. Well, what will immediately draw your eye is the six hearts. They're woven together, and it's to symbolize the six lives that were lost. It's also to show that both pain and joy are something that people experience together. So that's kind of the thing that I think people will see first. Then the tile wall, it's Waukesha Strong Community Tile Project that Carmen has spearheaded, will also draw your eye to it too. It's I think it's over 1,000 tiles. It's mainly blue, but it's got a couple different shades of blue in it, and that symbolizes like 1,000 people. Made the tiles. So individuals made those tiles and they become part of this project. And each of those tiles has some type of design etched into it and it becomes a permanent part of this memorial. So what it is the individuals in the community basically providing their support to all those who were injured, all those who were affected by this. The grounds, there's ribbons, there's benches that are kind of part of the ribbon of the hearts, and that also the paths are kind of ribbons also. Mm-hmm. At this time, you know, you won't be seeing the greenery, but in the future, it'll be extremely well landscaped park. And what I do see is that besides being a great place to just kind of sit and take in the beauty of it, it will also be a place for reflection for people to process their thoughts, their griefs, and to work through their injuries or the community's injuries.
And seeing that open heart being kind of this beacon to bring people in, does that make you, you know, what emotions come up for you with the heart?
Well, it's very, for me, it's very easy to get to have to be overwhelmed by emotions because the community went through so much. Mm. But it's also, there's also some happiness in there or some joy because how our community did respond is absolutely wonderful. Like I kind of keep saying it, but the community came together and supported those who were most injured. The other thing I also just want to add, which I didn't say, at 4:39 each day, the hearts will be lit up with a blue light for 6 minutes to also honor those who passed.
Oh, wow. Wow. Carmen, can you talk more about the Community Tile Project as part of the memorial and how it's come together?
Sure. I was actually one of the artists selected for another commissioned project, which is a sculpture, which will be another phase to the park that I'll be doing at a later date. And in that process, I was in meetings and I was asked if I had any ideas for some type of a community involvement in the park. And I said, give me 24 hours. Mm-hmm.
and I'll let you know and let me think about it. And literally it came to me overnight that we could have people create their own tiles. And so I wrote up the proposal, presented it to the commission, and they accepted it. And essentially it's actually about 1,200 tiles are on that wall, and they're each 6.5 by 6.5 inches. I've rolled out and pressed 1,400 pounds of clay and went all over the city. We did seminars or sessions with people all over the community where people could come and create their own tiles and etch them in. Literally, I've done them in bars, bowling alleys, churches, on the sidewalk in downtown Waukesha. I even had one of the canine dog police officers from the city of Waukesha embed their paw into one of the tiles. And so essentially, I would come to these events with the tile still wet and raw. And people would have, I would provide tools and help them. Some of them, I'll be honest, I have my hand in many of those tiles, helping people line up the letters. Or so many people would say, I'm not an artist, I don't know what I'm doing. And I would say to them, less is more, and just show what you want to share from your heart. And the amazing thing is that I didn't know what the reaction would be. I didn't know if people would be into the project or not into the project. And we initially started the project with a goal of, can you get 500 tiles, Carmen? I was like, I don't know. I don't know if 500 people are going to show up. And then 500 went to 1,038. And then 1,038, I got them all done. And then it was, can you get another 200? So literally, and that was like in the last 3 weeks, we cranked them out. And I have a huge thank you to South High School ceramic students and their teacher, Cody Gallis, as well as Tom Mancuso, who is one of the art coordinators for the district of Waukesha School District. The two of them were my lifeline because they helped me with getting all those tiles into the glaze, getting them bisqued. Well, first they get bisque, which means that they turn from clay to glass or ceramic. They get vitrified, and then they come back out, and then they get glazed, and they go back in the oven, and then we have to take them all out and pack them. And so you can imagine how many hours went into this process, and I am honored. I'm humbled by the fact that so many people in Waukesha embrace the project. We're gleeful to be a part of it. And I really do believe that it was a healing process for so many people. In one of our sessions, one of the young high school people from South High School Band that got hit met for the first time one of the nurses and her family that helped him at one of our tile sessions. So the whole tile session like did a whole full circle for people. I had people whose wife, one of the husbands, told me the story of what happened the night that he lost his wife. And I don't want to get emotional because it's so sad. And this man has so much more faith after this that to me, it's been incredible. And it was wonderful to meet him and to speak with him and to connect with him and his family and his grandchildren, his children. And so I know that it's a very small thing to go and make a tile, but on an emotional level, on a psychological level, I think it did a huge thing to heal many people during the process. I think even more so than I expected and more so than they expected when they got a little cold piece of clay put in front of them.
Oh, this is community through and through. And Carmen, thank you so much for describing the process and how many people are a part of it. We're talking about the opening of the Waukesha Christmas Parade Memorial in Grady Park with Carmen De La Paz, Waukesha-based carpenter, designer, and welder. And Waukesha Mayor Sean Riley is here. Mayor, I'm wondering if you would read the inscription near the base of the memorial. What would you read it? What does it say?
At the base of the memorial, it says, "We dedicate this memorial to the 6 lives tragically lost in the Waukesha Christmas Parade, the nearly 70 others who sustained physical injuries, and the countless individuals deeply impacted by the events on November 21st, 2021. This memorial also honors the first responders, healthcare workers, and bystanders whose bravery and quick response were crucial in providing aid and support that day. May this memorial stand as a testament to the strength and unity of our community, symbolizing how we come together in support and solidarity through times of profound loss and tragedy.
Thank you so much for reading that. At the ceremony, there will be the United Way's Waukesha Resiliency Center. What is available through this center, Mayor, and what will it be offering?
So the Resiliency Center has been in existence for about 2 years now, I believe. Between NAMI and United Way, we basically set up counseling for people impacted by the tragedy. So there are a number of professionals there and counselors that will meet with people. We do expect that, like when we have dedicated the other memorial and when we've had events, the Resiliency Center is there to provide help for those people who are, you know, feeling overwhelmed by the events and by their loss. So the Resiliency Center will have people there, but they're also available all the time. If you are someone who was impacted by the parade and you wish to have any type of mental health counseling or just want someone to talk to, the Resiliency Center is there for you. They'll be there. Tonight. But they're also there for you at any other time too.
Carmen, how has this project influenced or affected your work as an artist?
More than anything else, it impacts me because you don't realize how your art is going to impact everybody else. You hope and you wish and you create something usually in a bubble all by yourself in a studio. And when it's done, you bring it out to the world. And most of the time, especially because I work in television, what I do is create it. It goes onto the screen and I'm not in that living room. I don't know how the viewers see it or like it. And this particular project has allowed me to be fully immersed in the emotions of the process, which can only make any artist's work that much better. And it makes the importance of what you're contributing more. I'm more aware of that. Whereas before, you just do it and you put it out there and it goes. And if they like it, cool. But now it's like, but wait, you're actually affecting people with what you're doing. It actually matters. And I think that that's a huge, wonderful aspect to being an artist, to have that really fully understood and felt.
Mayor Riley and Carmen, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
That was Waukesha Mayor Sean Riley and Waukesha-based carpenter, designer, and welder Carmen De La Paz. They were talking about the opening of the Waukesha Parade Memorial at Grady Park. It's a space for reflection, healing, and remembrance of the six victims who lost their lives at the Waukesha Christmas Parade 3 years ago today. Our friends at PBS Wisconsin, they're about to release a new documentary showcasing Wisconsin lighthouses. And on a coming show, we get a preview of some of the cool stories behind these iconic structures and the lighthouse keepers who kept them going.
And we want to find out, do you have a favorite lighthouse on the Great Lakes? Have you climbed the stairs and toured one? How was the view? How'd it make you feel?
Share your stories. My favorite one from childhood is Split Rock in Two Harbors. I have vivid memories of it. Flashing beacon that really lit up those choppy, frigid Lake Superior waters at night.
Leave us a message or text us right now at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. You can also email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.